Rangers fans, even Celtic fans. It made sense. I'd have more privacy. But really, I should have stayed in Glasgow. Later on, I rented a small flat in the west end of Glasgow, and it was fine. But anyway, I drove back to the hotel. It was about an hour's drive from Glasgow. Lovely hotel, lovely suite. I lay on the bed, and my hip. I've never known pain like it. My hip was fucking screaming, just from the warm-up, from the training. It was all the movement. I hadn't moved properly in months. I hadn't been twisting, holding other players off. And it wasn't as if I could ease myself back to fitness. I'd be going back on the pitch in 2 weeks. I was going to be thrown straight into a game. I lay there thinking, I don't want to go back. But I need to. I have to. I was an experienced professional. I played more than 600 games. I could deal with anything. My hip was screaming. Not aching, screaming. What have you done? I couldn't budge. I thought to myself, you should have retired. You should have just packed it in. But I couldn't leave after my first day. Imagine how that would have looked. Celtic fans with their scarves and jerseys. No, I've got to go to work. Could I go on and tell them that my hip was at me? Would it be better tomorrow? I'd have a 45-minute drive the next morning, maybe an hour back to the training ground. I'd better leave it a bit earlier. I'd hardly be able to drive. It was my own fault. No one forced me to stay in Edinburgh. But the hip. Fucking hell. I should have just packed it in. I should have been braver. Sometimes you have to be courageous enough to say no. An Irish friend of mine once told me, no is a sentence. One of my strengths earlier in my career had been my ability to say no to people. I'd be very clear about not overdoing things and knowing the limits of my job. Then there's the shame. I was under contract. People had bought jerseys with my name on them. I didn't want to let anyone down. And the feeling that I wouldn't even be able to play. Not long before, less than a year ago, I'd been in the Highbury Tunnel imposing myself on the game before it even started. Now I was lying in a hotel bed, wondering if I could get through training. I had to go on the next day. Of course I had. It was my job. I needed to train. I had that game coming up in a couple of weeks. My attitude throughout my career had been, you train how you play. I should have adapted. I should have taken it easy in training. I wasn't going to win plaudits for training on Tuesday. I'd get them if I played well on Saturday. I don't think I felt old, in football terms. But physically, I was. My body was old. But I was new in the dressing room. And I wanted to impress. You have to. The player's job, every day at training, is to impress the manager and his coaching staff. Gordon had never seen me train before. Tommy Burns had never seen me train. They'd seen me play, but they hadn't seen me train. The training didn't get any easier. Before he took charge of Celtic, the teams Gordon had managed had always been up against it. Southampton, Coventry, always fighting for survival. His teams were always hard-working, and his training was designed around that. I liked it. I just wished that I could have coped with it better. You'd get changed at Celtic Park, and you'd get in your car and drive to the training ground up the road. It's different now, but this was when I played. The biggest challenge was, whose car were you going in? We'd be sitting in the dressing room. Whose turn is it? Because after training you'd have to drive back, and 9 times out of 10 the rain was pissing down, so a gang of players would be getting into your car covered in muck. I enjoyed that. The bit of banter. Listen, lads, I've a Bentley. Nobody's getting into it with their fucking boots on. I got to know the lads in the car. I'd go with Dion Dublin or Petrov. We'd only be in the car for 5 minutes. We'd have the crack. I had the United car for the first few weeks, so I invited everyone into the back of it, boots as well. I ended up leasing a Golf to keep my own car clean, but mostly so I could get around discreetly in Glasgow. At around that time, I was asked by somebody in Celtic's administration if I'd mind not being paid until after January, because I wouldn't actually be playing until then. I said, but I've signed my contract, and I'm training, and you're selling jerseys in the shop. I want my wages from when I signed. The glamour of it. The fucking glamour of it. Michael had begged me not to sign for Celtic. He wasn't happy with the negotiations, or the take-it-or-leave-it approach. But I still think that if I hadn't signed for Celtic, I would have regretted it. They'd offered me the least money of any of the clubs. I read somewhere that I went to Celtic for 40 or 50,000 a week. It was 15 basic they offered me. I wasn't motivated by the money, or just the money. I think there might have been a bit of guilt about that when I left United. The amount I'd been earning there and earning so much for something I loved doing anyway. I'd said once or twice in interviews over the years, I'd like to play for Celtic one day. I'd said it casually, but now I felt I couldn't go back on my word. And I wanted to play against Rangers in an Old Firm game. For the atmosphere, the buzz, the experience. I played for United against Rangers, and it was electric. I remember thinking, if it's as good as this when it's Rangers against United, what must it be like when it's against Celtic? I've been up to see Celtic play Rangers several times, at Ibrox too. They were massive games. Celtic were going to play in my testimonial at United the following May. It had already been agreed before I'd left United. So I wondered, if I don't sign for Celtic, would that be awkward? But more than any other consideration, I just thought, I want to treat myself here. I'm going to go where I want to go, and fuck the money. I wouldn't have called it a dream, but I'd always liked Celtic, and the Irish connection would have been in the back of my mind. I felt a bit of loyalty to them. Usually, when you're making a decision about your career, you consider everything. The challenge, the family, location. But this decision was a purely selfish one. I just wanted to play for Glasgow Celtic. Celtic is a special club. My first game was against Clyde, away, in the third round of the Scottish Cup. We were beaten 2-1. It was a nightmare. I wasn't happy with my own game. I did okay, but okay wasn't enough. After the game, the disappointment. As I was taking my jersey off, I noticed the Nike tag was still on it. When I got on the bus, John Hartson, really good guy, was already sitting there and he was eating a packet of crisps and a fizzy drink. I said to myself, welcome to hell. We went back on the bus to Celtic Park, and a lot of fans were waiting, having a right go at Gordon and some of the players as we got off the bus. Being knocked out of the cup by Clyde was a massive shock. But Tommy Burns, I take my hat off Tom, stood on the steps and had a go at the Celtic fans. Some of those lads were ready for a bit of action. You're not Celtic fans, he said. You've got to get behind the team. I remember thinking, this is a good start. My first game, and already the fans were up in arms and one of the staff was on the steps of Celtic Park having to defend the manager. So that was a nice, gentle introduction. My first Old Firm game was at Ibrox, and we won 1-0. It was brilliant. It lived up to all my expectations, probably because we won. Magic Zarafsky, a Polish lad, scored the goal. The start of my Celtic career hadn't been great, losing at Clyde, and angry fans. But then, not long after, we go and win at Rangers. Well, I'm thinking, this is what it's all about. The atmosphere was brilliant. Fucking electric. The hatred. I enjoyed all that. I got a yellow card for a foul on Purcell, and they were baying for a red card. Physically, I must have felt good. I was man of the match, and that was a little moment of satisfaction, another tiny victory. The dressing room afterwards was great. Again, it's what football is all about. But at this stage, I was taking painkillers before every match. An injection in the bum, diclofenic, or Voltarol. The cause of the pain was a labral tear of the hip, and I understood that playing on could worsen the tear. I was taking an injection before the game and one at half-time just to get through. And you do get through. But the consequences arrived the day after. And the next day. I'd be in bits. Mind you, I'd have been in bits anyway. The Rangers game was a physically tough one. I doubt if pain-killing injections are as regular now as they used to be, because of the advances in sports science. I don't think players would put up with it. The painkillers just hide the pain, and they wear off. So there was the double whammy. I was going to suffer anyway, and then the hip would be at me too. I could justify taking the painkillers for the game against Rangers because I knew it was going to be tough. But now I was taking them for every game. That was when I thought, this is not good. I'd been taking them in England, but only for the big games, Arsenal, City, when I knew I'd have to be physically at my best. Now, common sense was telling me that my days were numbered. We played Hibernian a few weeks later away at Easter Road, and I remember feeling a bit caught out. I'd done my homework on Rangers, but I didn't know much about Hibs. I remember thinking, fuck it, this is hard. They had a couple of lads in the middle of the park. Kevin Thompson was one of them. He went on to Rangers in Middlesbrough. They were both excellent. We won, but it was a bit of a shock. I thought that I should have been dominating these two, or any Hibs players. But my mind was lying. They had very good players. We won the League Cup in March against Dunfermline, but I went off injured, running around like a madman. I tore my hamstring, making a forward run. We won, but I didn't really feel involved in the celebrations. I was embarrassed. I'd come on as a sub in the semi-final in the last minute of the second half. I played for about 90 seconds. It wasn't a great experience. But I was coming back from injury, another one. It led to my only real disagreement with Gordon Strachan. After most games, Gordon would let me go home to Manchester to do my recovery. But he'd organised a practice game for the next day. I was still getting my fitness up, and I think Stylian Petrov was also coming back from an injury, so he'd organised this game 11v11. I said, I usually head straight home after a game. He said, I'd like you to play in the game. I could see why he wanted that. But then he said he needed to see what I could do. And I said, have you not seen me play 600 and odd games down in England? And he said, no. No, I just need to see you. I stayed over and played the next day, and actually, I enjoyed playing the practice game. But that was where my career was now, playing practice games. So on the manager what I could do. We beat Hearts at Celtic Park in early April and won the league title. I was injured that day. I remember going into the dressing room. It was hard to join in the celebrations. I hadn't played enough. I won league and league cup medals with Celtic, but I never really contributed. Celtic won the league, but they were about 15 points clear when I signed for them. I got man of the match away at Rangers, and that pleased me a little bit. I look back at my time there, and I'm a bit embarrassed by it. I didn't play too often. 12 or 13 games, I think. I was on the bench 4 or 5 times. I tore my hamstring twice. And the reason you get injured a lot is your body's not right. I wasn't fit. My hip, my strides, I was trying too hard to impress. I was trying to play like a 21-year-old. Look what a player you've signed. I was in cuckoo land. I would have been a bit cleverer if I'd still been at United. I would have been thinking, I've earned my stripes here. I know my position. I don't have to be running around like a teenager. But at Celtic, I thought, they've signed me. The fans all think they have a top player. I think I was a top player. But I hadn't sprinted in years. At United, I just read the game and was in the right positions. At Celtic, I was going, I better start getting the odd goal here to impress them. A childish attitude. Stupid. Why didn't I go to Everton? I would have regretted not going to Celtic, and I couldn't go to both. But Everton would have been good. I spoke to Phil Neville, who'd moved there earlier in the season. I knew that there were good fitness people there who could have helped me. I liked David Moyes, their manager. The chairman, Bill Kenwright, was very good with Michael in negotiations. They offered me a lot more than Celtic were paying me. But I think I might have found it hard playing for another English team. Which is stupid, I suppose, because it's business. Although I would never summarise my years at United as business. It wasn't business to me. Everton might have given me another lease of life. Might have had 2 or 3 more years there. The system they played would have suited me. I would have been a proper sitting midfielder. It doesn't keep me awake at night. And I'm not knocking Celtic. It's a brilliant club. I've no regrets. Even though it didn't work out. I go up to Celtic quite a bit, and I enjoy it as much as anything. I should be embarrassed because I hardly kicked a ball for them. It's almost like a family up there. You play it for us, you're one of us. I feel lucky to have played for Celtic. Maybe I was putting off the inevitable decision. I was frightened of saying to myself, I've retired. My testimonial was on the 9th of May 2006. A player's testimonial can be very rewarding financially, but I think it's tradition that makes it such a big day. You're thanking the fans, and they're thanking you. It was a chance for me to say goodbye to the United fans, a huge incentive for me. I felt a bit bad going to Old Trafford with Celtic. I was thinking I've only been with them 2 minutes. An important part of the testimonial is the presence for both teams. The Celtic lads were at me. I'd better buy them something good. If the player who's having the testimonial doesn't give the team's decent presents, he'll be criticised, privately, for the rest of his life. So, at the end of the season, I was wondering about my career and my future. But the pressure I was really feeling was coming from the Celtic lads and having to choose a present for them. I ended up buying 50 Omega watches, 25 for each dressing room. They were good watches, so I reckon they wouldn't be slagging me off. Celtic love going down to United. They like playing against English opposition. A testimonial is a friendly game, it's a celebration. But they still want to win. And the Celtic fans love it too. The atmosphere was brilliant that night, very special. I had my family with me. It was nice to be back. It had been arranged that I'd play a half for each of them. I played for Celtic in the first half. I went into the Celtic players at half-time and I told them, lads, I'm going to play with them in the second half. There was plenty of banter with the Celtic players. I always enjoyed the crack in the Celtic dressing room. Stylian Petrov was a good lad. Neil Lennon and John Hartson, all decent lads. And Dion Dublin. Myself and Dion went out for a few meals together and I generally ended up paying for them. The testimonial just about covered my food bill. So we went back into the United dressing room. The kit man, Albert, was there. All right, Roy. And plenty of banter from the lads. I put the United kit on. I felt 10 feet tall. It was like I was putting an old jumper on. This is my kit. I didn't want the feeling. I was fighting it. But I couldn't help myself. I remember thinking, we'd better fucking win. I was with United. We won 1-0. Ronaldo scored. And I thought, now I've got to go back into the Celtic dressing room and take more stick from them. But it was so frustrating. I kept wondering, why did it all go pear-shaped? That self-destruct button. Anger has always been part of my personality. I don't see it as a bad thing or bad word. My reputation has always been, oh, he's angry, he's always grumpy. And I probably played up to it when I was a player. But a lot of my sending offs wouldn't have been because of anger. They were caused by frustration. There's a big difference. I don't ever remember getting sent off when we were 3-0 up. When I've been angry, that's been me defending myself. I think the man upstairs has designed me in a certain way. And this provides me with a form of energy, a form of self-defense. I drop my guard sometimes, but when I do, and become more laid back, It can backfire on me. See my anger as a useful tool. Me expressing my anger. Not every 2 minutes. I'm releasing something. I can control it better now than in the past. It's a family trait. Without a doubt, I get it from my dad. You can see it. A lack of patience. Low tolerance levels. It's probably one of my many contradictions. I don't get as angry as people might think, but it helps me. As soon as I walk into a room, I know people are apprehensive. I know they are. They're expecting some sort of skinhead tug. So, I've a good way of disappointing them. I think I treat people pretty well. I've got friends I know for 30 years. If I was some impatient tug, I think they'd keep their distance from me. I've looked at my anger for what it is. It's just anger. I won't beat myself up about it. Anger is an energy. And when you lose a lot of energy, it's just like after a football match. You're drained. There's a massive drop. Someone once said to me, an ex-player, and it's going back to my drinking days, he said that going out with me was like going out with a time bomb. The reputation probably keeps people away from me, and that often suits me, although I'm not saying that's a good thing. So anger is a useful trait. But when I'm backed into a corner, when I get into situations, professional or personal, I know deep down that when I lose my rag, I might be in the right. It doesn't matter. I know I'm going to be the loser. I will lose out. Saipan at the World Cup, ultimately I lost. Or when I left United, when I could have stayed a bit longer if it had been handled differently. I was the one who lost. I know that. That's the madness of me. When I'm going off on one, even when I might be right, there's a voice in my head going, you'll pay for this. That's the self-destruct button. I don't know if it's low self-esteem. Things might be really going well, and I don't trust it. It's not going to last, or why am I getting this? Why are things going well? I'll fuck things up a little bit, then feel a bit better myself. I might be buying a car. Who do you think you are buying a new car? And I'll fuck it up. I'll drag things down around me, and then I'll get started again. When I get back up to the top, I look and see that there were things that I wasn't happy with, and I could have managed differently. That self-destruct button is definitely there. And I suffer for it. With my drinking, I used to go missing for a few days. I think it was my way of switching off, never mind the consequences. It was my time. It was self-destructive, I can see that. But I'm still drawn to it. Not the drink, but a bit of madness. The irresponsibility. I can be sitting at home, the most contented man on the planet. An hour later I go, Jesus, it's hard work this. When I go back to Cork, I can fall back into that old routine. I'm going to go off on one here. It doesn't worry me. I kind of go in, have a look round, go, nah, and come back out of it. But sometimes I don't know what's best for myself, and that's why I've got great faith. The man upstairs looks after me. I just have to trust him a bit more. I've learned to say sorry pretty quickly if I think I've been out of order, or sometimes I can just say sorry to move on. Maybe self-destruct is too strong a phrase. Maybe I play games with myself. I have great stability in my life. But then, that worries me. I like my home comforts, but then I want to be this hellraiser. But I want my porridge in the morning. I want my wife and kids around me. I've dipped into the madness, and I don't like it that much. I like walking my dogs in the morning. Maybe I'm like every man on the planet, I don't know. I want a bit more than what's on offer. My midlife crisis has been going on for years. I'd never really let myself self-destruct. I want to have my pride, and I like nice things in my life. I don't want to be another fallen ex-star. I'm quite good at living in the day. Really, what is cool for me is sleeping well at night and having people around who I love. There's a difference between anger and rage. With anger, when I've been angry. Somebody with me, or even myself, can pull it back. There's a comeback. I'll be able to pull myself back in if I was angry. But with rage, I've gone beyond all that. It's beyond anger. It's rare, even more so now that I'm not playing football, and I'm not sure that I ever felt pure rage on the football pitch. All the times I was sent off, it was frustration or a controlled anger. There's no control with rage. It's not good, especially the aftermath. You're coming down, and it's a long way to go. The come down can be shocking in terms of feeling down or embarrassed by my behaviour, even if I feel that I wasn't in the wrong. I haven't felt real rage in a long time, thank God. I was in Barbados with my family when I decided to leave Celtic. This was a few weeks after the end of the season. I just thought, I can't go back because of my hip. I'd seen the specialist, Richard Villar, at the end of the season for an update. And he said, basically, Rye, the more you play, you'll do more damage to the hip. He followed up the meeting with a letter. In essence, your right hip is clinically a little worse than it was when we first met. The MRI scan, now it has been reported, demonstrates some slight damage within the labrum, cartilage of the hip, but also some early degeneration within the articular cartilage, gristle, of the hip. In essence, this implies early osteoarthritis of the joint. Under normal circumstances, a joint such as yours would not be something I would expect to interfere with life too greatly. Clearly, however, when you are stressing your right hip enormously, changes such as I have outlined above do become significant. In terms of a feature of the hip such as this, it is obviously very difficult to be sure. Nevertheless, it is likely that the rate of deterioration of your joint would be in proportion to the amount of strain which is placed through it. At the same time, one should be aware that degenerate joints do not always need to be totally rested. In fact, a certain degree of movement is a very good thing for them. I realise that you have an enormously difficult decision to make, and I do not envy you or the situation at all. However, I do hope that our discussion in clinic, combined with the letter I have written, helps you towards reaching a satisfactory conclusion, and, as I am sure you know, I am always here to support you should you need further advice. I was embarrassed by the decision to retire. Really, I'd only just arrived at Celtic. Even when I was at United, I'd be embarrassed going to work and saying, I'm injured. The shame of it. The hard part was making the decision. Just that. Coming to the conclusion. I'd had a chat about it with my wife, with the kids playing around. It wasn't a committee meeting. I didn't talk to anyone else. I'd made my mind up. I rang Gordon Strachan and said, Gordon, it's about coming back. My hip's playing up and... Do you know, I think I'm going to have to call it a day. And Gordon went, all right. Yep, okay. Yep, it's for the best. And I was saying to myself, try and persuade me for fuck's sake, at least pretend. I was relieved. It's about making a decision. I can procrastinate about lots of things, but once I make the decision, it's made. Let's get on with it. I think I'd been frightened of accepting that I was going to retire, and it might have been why I didn't like Barbados. After I made a decision, and after I spoke to Gordon, there was still fear, but a nicer fear, even excitement. What was going to happen? Now, life starts. 6. You had the penthouse in Sydney Harbour? And the Lamborghini, all the women, a hard life. But I knew he loved football. He loved the game, and he liked the challenge. I said, do you fancy coming back to Sunderland? Measuring yourself after football is difficult. You lose your identity. You lose what you stand for. For years you strive to be a footballer. Then you have it. You're like an actor. Every Saturday. Then it's gone. You feel like you're starting out again. It shouldn't be a surprise, because when you start out in your career, you know it's going to finish at 34 or 35. You know it is. But I'm not sure that your emotions know it. Your head tells you lies, and there's a fear of accepting. This is it. Then there's that big question. What do I do? I had a few bob in the bank, and I had a nice way of living, and it wasn't cheap. Football had been brilliant to me, mind-boggling. But all those bills were still coming in. I wanted to go on nice holidays. There was my family to look after. There was that excitement. What's next? But I also knew that whatever I did, it would never be as good as playing football. Never. When I was a footballer, I was doing exactly what I wanted to do. But that stopped. I was a footballer, and then I was an ex-footballer, whatever the X covers. What I stood for at United, the winning, playing with injuries, the red cards, I loved all that. I remember thinking, I shouldn't be loving it this much. But I was doing what I loved doing. It was Everton. People might say that it was a job, and I do understand what a football club means to supporters. People who travel up and down the country, who pay big money and are often frustrated. I used to be like that at United. I often shared their frustration. I was almost going, fucking hell, I can't believe this. I'm going to be found out soon. Somebody's going to say, hey, you. I think that was part of it. I think that helped me in my career, the fear of being found out, of getting away with being paid so well for doing something that I love doing so much. That, and knowing deep down, I'll never get that feeling ever again. That's the sad part. When I left the United training ground, I should have stopped playing football, because I knew it would never, ever be the same. That was why it was so hard to leave. That was why I was upset. No matter what I do for the rest of my life, nothing will replace it. That's the big shock. Knowing that for the rest of your life, everything was going to be disappointment, job-wise. Nothing could come near to it. I was 34. The challenge for me now was, don't self-explode. It was a case of, what can I enjoy? I wasn't afraid of becoming the ex-footballer, where everything is associated with your past. But I don't really live in the past. I like getting people's respect, but I don't want to live in their memories. Remember that goal you got against Arsenal? Yeah. I feel like saying to people, you need to move on. That was 20 years ago. It's like your identity. He was a Man United player. And it's still part of mine, whether I like it or not. Wherever I go in the world, oh, Keane, Man United. It could be anywhere. It could be China. Keane, Man United. I could easily become a walking museum, and I didn't want that. I didn't miss the training once I'd stopped. I didn't miss the people, the companionship, that much, or the banter. My injuries had been taking a toll on me. My hip had been playing me up. So I saw the last few years as a bonus. I just thought, every game's great. Every training session. I think it's the people around you who suffer more than anyone else. My family, parents and brothers, sister, uncles and aunts. For years, I had people coming over from Ireland to see me and to get a game in. But that stopped. I felt sad for them. Sad that they were missing out on the buzz that football and my career had brought them. My wife and kids were fine. They'd always stepped back from the public side of my life. They almost knew, more than I did, even the youngest ones, that it wasn't going to last. You miss the money. You've had a very good standard of living. You miss those wages coming in, hundreds of thousands a month. It's about adapting. You have to kind of grow up and accept it. When you're a top club, everything is done for you. You end up living in this little bubble. Wherever you go, people are looking after you, and everything's VIP or upgrades. All of a sudden, that stops. I had days when self-pity kicked in. Why me and poor me? The United stuff, how it ended. I hear myself complaining. It happened. Jesus, count your blessings. Grow up and take responsibility for what you're going to do next, like most other men out there. Most other men who lose their jobs or who work for 25 years and get a poxy watch at the end of it. The answer to the question, what are you going to do for me, should start with, well, do it yourself. Maybe I'm being arrogant because football was good to me financially. But I think there has to be that starting point. Take responsibility for yourself. Find some work or adapt your lifestyle. Downsize your house. Have fewer holidays. Hold on to the car for a few extra years. It's about everyday things, your lifestyle. I sat down with the kids and gave them the news about how things were going to change. It wasn't anything too drastic. There'd be fewer holidays and so on. Those days are over. I was trying to put the frighteners on them a little bit. The kids picked that up. They were looking straight through me going, get on with the lecture, we want to watch TV. I began to realise that I'd enjoyed the luxuries, the holidays, more than anybody else. A few months later, we said we wouldn't be going away for one of the school breaks. I remember saying to my wife, why did I go on about the cutbacks? Because I was the one who wanted to go on holiday. I'd almost been putting the onus on the kids. Even going back, I don't want to go to Real Madrid because of my children. They'd have upped and left in 2 minutes. The kids can become scapegoats. Blame the kids. Hey kids, everyone together. Oh no, not another keen lecture tonight. I had done a certain amount of preparation. I'd been doing my coaching badges. And there's no actual badge. It's a certificate, an award. I gained my UEFA B award in 2004. It's like any education. You start at the bottom. In the B course, you have to show basic organisational skills. Say a session with 4 or 5 players, or a drill, setting up cones, laying out bibs, everything. It's so basic, it's difficult. You've been playing at a professional level, and now you have to work with kids or lads who rarely kick a ball. It isn't easy. A lot of players who spent 10 or 15 years trying to get to the top struggle with it. I found it hard. It's almost like having to go back and do your driving test. I can drive, but I'm not sure I can tell you the rules of the road. I was starting the next step, my UEFA A badge, in 2006. The summer I stopped playing. You go up a level. You're organising full training sessions, 11v11. And there's more on tactics, say how you prepare a game against a team that plays 4-3-3. I found a higher level much easier. It was more familiar. Still though, you're in charge now, not just part of it. You're not a player anymore. The next step is the pro license. It's a requirement to manage in any of the top leagues. It's not cheap. I think it was 6 or 7 grand. There's a discipline to it, which is good, and you meet top people, and it's nerve-wracking. It's about working at the top level, and not just coaching, dealing with club boards and chief executives, budgets, and in media. They'd set up mock press conferences. You'd be challenged and advised on how to deal with different questions. There were session plans to be written, and you had to log your coaching sessions. This can be a problem for a lot of ex-players. Writing of any type is torture. Some of them wouldn't have been great at school, I know I wasn't. As a player, you'd have been involved in thousands of training sessions with different coaches. But now you had to become the teacher. It was difficult. And standing up in front of a group, that wasn't too bad for me, because I'd been the club captain, and I had some experience of that, and some sort of leadership qualities. The badges are hard work, but there's big satisfaction too in getting them done. I'd wanted to get started on the courses while I was still a player. I'd started the first, the UEFA B, when I was 31 or 32. It's the mistake a lot of ex-players make. They wait until they're 34 or 35 before they decide to start their coaching awards. And quite often, players don't do it while they're still playing because it's time-consuming and they'd have to sacrifice part of their holidays. The expense is off-putting too, especially if you want to get to pro license level, although the PFA will contribute 50% of the fee. While you're doing the courses, you're networking. You meet nice people. I ended up working with some of the men I met when I was doing my coaching course. I met Ian McParland and Gary Ablett, who both worked with me later at Ipswich. And it was Gary who put me in touch with Antonio Gomez, who became my fitness coach at Sunderland. You end up meeting people you'll work with, or against. I knew I'd have to be ready. Actually, in a way, I'd been ready since I was a kid. I'd been lucky, but I'd made my own bit of luck. I was playing League of Ireland football, and I was doing a fast course. There was nobody ringing me to come over to England. As much as I lacked confidence in some things, there were other areas of my life where I went, give me a go at that. I wrote to a number of clubs in England, looking for a trial. I offered to pay a part of the cost, although I didn't have a penny. I got a letter back from Forrest saying that if I was good enough, I'd be spotted. I was spotted. By Forrest. When I went there for my trial, I knew I wouldn't be going back to Cork. There was nothing there and no prospects. In my first week at Forrest, they put me with the kids. No one saw me. I was 18 or 19. They apologised and asked me to come back. They'd organise a game. I said, just give me the game. I wasn't one for going round cones. Give me a game. They told me there'd be a game at the City Ground, and Brian Clough was going to be there. And I thought, brilliant. I didn't go, is he? Oh, fuck. I went, brilliant. When it was over, and they told me they wanted to sign me, I wasn't cocky enough to say I knew you would. But I taught it. It was what I'd been waiting for since I was a kid. Since I was 8 years of age, at Rockmount. Even back then, I played for Rockmount instead of my local club, Mayfield, because Rockmount had the better players. And I knew that at 8 or 9 years of age. Mayfield would have been convenient. But convenient was boring. I needed that challenge. Good players, good people around you, pushing each other. When I was 13 or 14, Eric Hogan, a decent lad, he still plays for the over-35s in Cork, he wouldn't go training one night because he got a new skateboard. I fell out with him. We didn't speak for a year because he wouldn't go training. I always had that drive. Stig your skateboard. As I matured and the situations got bigger, I'd think back to that skateboard. Stick your fucking skateboard. Sunderland should have been a nightmare. It had 7 or 8 Irish owners. There'd be a lot of interference. They'd all feel they owned the club. I'd have too many people to answer to. But it was the opposite. Because there were 7 or 8 of them, no one felt he was in charge. Niall Quinn was the front, the public face. The Sunderland fans loved him. And the answer to the owners. And the fact that they were Irish turned out to be fine. You could have a bit of banter with them. They trusted myself and Niall to get on with it. We were the footballing people. Sunderland had been relegated at the end of the previous season, 05-06. Then Niall formed a consortium, Drumaville, made up mostly of Irish property developers, including Charlie Chalk, the Dublin publican. They took control of the club in July, but then they went into pre-season and the start of the season itself, without a manager. Niall had to take on the job temporarily while they kept looking. They lost their first 4 league games. They'd met me earlier in the summer, soon after I'd stopped playing. Niall had contacted Michael Kennedy. I wasn't that surprised. Football's a small world, and they would have known that I'd stopped playing, and probably that I was doing my coaching courses. As for the history between myself and Niall, Niall would have been trying to do what he thought was right for the club. He would have been big enough not to let it get in the way. They sent a helicopter over to Manchester and flew me to Dublin. They were trying to impress me, of course. I was crossing the Irish Sea in a helicopter, but I was wondering, what am I in for here? I'm not sure where the meeting took place. Some estate. A manor house outside Dublin. All the lads in the Drumaville consortium were there, and Niall was too. As the helicopter landed, I saw that he was a few feet away, beside the helipad, waiting with the other people. I got out of the helicopter, kissed the ground and blessed everybody. The pub has arrived! No, I didn't. I got out of the helicopter, walked across the Nile, and we shook hands. He said, do you want 5 or 10 minutes to ourselves before you go in? It was the first time I'd spoken to Niall since the World Cup. I don't think the conversation would have happened if Niall hadn't been involved in the consortium. So it was an opportunity to let bygones be bygones. We went into a room together and I said, "Listen, to Saipan stuff, whatever happens with Sunderland now, we need to move on anyway." He agreed. "Yeah, yeah." And that was it. I went in and met the lads. It was all very casual. I had a suit on, but I didn't feel like I was being interviewed or that I was under any pressure. They asked me would I be interested in the job. I said, "I'm not sure what I want to do yet, lads. I'll have a think about it." They spoke about what various players were earning, contracts and wages, and about getting players in and out. I was going, "One step at a time, let me have a think about it." They were basically giving me a plan. They seemed keen. I thought the job might be mine if I wanted it. They'd just taken over the club, and you have to have a manager in place before the start of pre-season, if only to save face. Mick McCarthy had gone in March, before the consortium took over the club, and Kevin Ball had been the caretaker until the end of the season. They'd been relegated with one of the lowest points totals ever. I went home and I told Michael a few days later, "It's not for me." I wanted to focus on finishing my coaching courses. I was about to start the UEFA A. I didn't want to jump into a job too quickly. Sunderland were disappointed and over the next month or so they couldn't find anyone to take the job. Which still amazes me. I heard that Martin O'Neill and Sam Allardyce had turned it down before they'd spoken to me. At that stage, I wasn't 100% sure what I wanted to do. I genuinely wasn't certain if management or coaching were for me. There was a stricter divide between the two roles back then. The courses weren't exactly whetting my appetite for coaching. I'd often thought, "Well, this is a pain in the arse. There's a coaching expression, being out on the grass." I wasn't sure that that was what I wanted. But I understood that the courses had to be done. I thought I'd be more interested in management and running a club. But if I did take the job, I didn't want to be doing the courses while it was starting. Paul Ince and Gareth Southgate had had to do that. If things didn't start well, I didn't want the accusation thrown at me, "Well, you didn't finish your coaching badges." And financially, I didn't have to jump into a job. I started my UEFA A course that summer. Then I went on holiday for a few weeks in August. I was in Portugal when the season started, and I watched a few matches on television. Sunderland were struggling badly. They played Bury away in the League Cup on a Tuesday night, and they were beaten. Niall was interviewed after the game. He was their temporary manager. He looked about 100. My sister texted me, "Did you see Niall Quinn? You need to help him out." I looked at Niall, and I rang Michael Kennedy the next day. I asked him to get in touch with Sunderland. "If they still want me, I'll go for it." I'd been with my family all summer. It had been great. But I didn't want to be with them all the time. I'm a dad. I needed to go out and earn a living. I wanted my kids to see me going to work. The consortium came back. "It's there for you if you want it." And I decided to go for it. My best decisions are always the quick ones. I wasn't thinking about staff or tactics or we'll need 10 players. No master plan. It was just, I'll go for it. One step at a time. From a business point of view, they knew what they were getting. Obviously, I was way behind Martin and Sam in terms of experience. I'd never managed a team before. It was a proper gamble for them, and it was a gamble for me. But they'd have been thinking about ticket sales too. I think if you'd asked Niall at the time, he'd have said, "We're not too worried about the coaching credentials. We need a boost." They'd lost their identity, lost their spark. They probably thought, "He's the man." I was the marquee signing, and I don't shy away from that. 5 defeats in 5 games, and it was a shocking start, especially for a team that had just been relegated. Bury, who knocked them out of the League Cup, were the lowest team in the league, 92nd. But Sunderland weren't as bad as the results were suggesting. A lot of those players had just been in the Premiership. It didn't matter to me if they'd been relegated with 1 point or 35, they were still a Premiership outfit. On the other hand, I wasn't thinking about promotion. I wasn't associated with the club. I had no loyalty to them, unlike Niall. I was able to go in cold. I'm very good at living in the now, and my reputation as a player probably helped. There was a certain fear, what's he going to do? But I know what I'm good at, and I thought, I'll be good with these players. What helped make me jump from player to manager was the experience I'd had at United and my responsibilities as captain. I had a bit of common sense to me, but I hadn't given the prospect that much thought, and it had never been a dream. I don't think you grow up dreaming of being a manager. I just thought, let's give it a go. We'll see what happens here. The complications of the job, board meetings, getting staff organised, even meeting the parents of young players. I was gung-ho about facing all that. We'll see how that goes. If I'd sat down and considered every aspect of it, I might never have gone into management. But if you keep that childlike love of the game, you're inclined to think, I'll adapt to that, and I'll have good people around me. From Monday to Friday, my job is to try and get a good result on Saturday. Sunderland were playing West Brom at home the following weekend, and I'd phoned Michael. I was back in Manchester by then, and I drove up to watch the match with Tony Loughlin. Tony was going to be my first team coach. Nothing had been announced yet. I wanted to have a look at the team and the training ground. There were 14,000 people there in a stadium with a capacity of 42,000. They won 2-0. But I don't claim credit for that. It was what I'd expected. They were a half-decent team. I remember thinking, they're not bad, these. They'd just been having a hard time. A few injuries, confidence. It was exciting watching the team I was going to manage. I knew the potential was there. Niall showed me around the training ground, the Academy of Light, the next day, and introduced me to the team. Michael was handling the negotiations. We knew they would be straightforward, and that we were in a great position. It wasn't going to be a case of, I've got you now, lads. But I'd been seen at the West Brom match. There was talk around the place. There'd been a bit of embarrassment about other possible managers. They'd be lynched if they didn't get the deal done with me. Niall had had a bash at the job and it hadn't gone well. He knew it was hard work. So I thought I'd get a little bit of grace. Everything fell into place. I got a brilliant contract, over $1 million a year, a lot of money for a championship job, and my first job. I suppose what usually happens is you're offered a short contract, you ask for a longer one and you meet in the middle. But Sunderland offered me a 5-year deal and I said I only wanted to sign for 3. I was confident enough, but I wanted to see how it would go. I was still thinking like a footballer. A shorter deal and keep your options open. I should have been thinking of job security and the financial consequences of being sacked. I've learned since that, contractually, the day you take over at a club is the day you start to leave. Most of the contract details are about what happens at the end. You're already negotiating your settlement. It's such a negative way to go into a job. You should be upbeat. But most of the negotiations are about how much it will cost to get rid of you. The distance from my home to Sunderland was about 2.5 hours in the car. The plan was the family would follow me. We'd move house up to the area and we'd find a Catholic school for the kids. Myself and Tony took training for the first time the day after I'd signed my contract. I knew Tony at Nottingham Forest. He was a player there when I arrived. He only played a couple of first-team games before he left because of injuries. We were together a few years at Forest, and I'd always kept in touch with him. I kept in touch with a few of the Forest players, Tony and Gary Charles. When I came to Forest, I didn't have a car, and Tony would bring me to play snooker, and Gary Charles used to drive me around sometimes. We go to the pictures together. They were nice to me. Simple as that. Tony did his coaching badges when he was 21 or 2 at Forest. He did them on Sunday mornings with some of the other players. I'd be lying in bed, hungover, hearing him collect Gary Bauer, who I was sharing a house with, as they were heading off to do their coaching course. And I remember saying to myself, idiots. Tony had a lot of experience at this stage. He was coaching at Leicester City's academy. And when I did my own courses, he helped me a bit with the session plans that I had to hand in. I'd always thought if I got a management job, I'd ask Tony to come with me. A good coach and a good friend, and someone I could trust. We enjoyed each other's company. I don't remember us laughing, but I'd like to think we did. He's coaching at Burnley now, with Sean Dyche and Ian Woon, two ex-players who were also at Forest when we were there. That's how the game works. We took training, and we started looking at the staff and players. I thought, my God, there's a lot of work to be done. They weren't great. They were nothing like a promotion team. But they were near the bottom of the table, so there was only one way to go. I loved it from there on. From the very beginning, I thought it was brilliant. Niall trusted me to get on with it. We had to spend money, although not as much as was often reported. We were heading towards League One. We'd got used to losing. Throughout the season, we invested roughly 3.5 million in players, taking into account players coming in and going out. But now we only had a couple of days to get a few players in before the transfer deadline. The transfer deadline makes people panic. That's why transfer fees go through the roof. Agents are holding guns to the heads of chairmen. It backfires on everybody. We identified 6 or 7 players, which is a lot. Meeting the players, medicals to be organised, personal terms. But Niall and the chief executive, Peter Walker, were brilliant. They got it done for me. I asked for 6 players and they came back with 6. It made sense, of course. We were all after the same thing, success. I knew my arrival would give us a bit of a boost, but we had to keep it up. I brought in 6. 6 players I'd played with. 6 good characters. They'd all played for their countries. I'd had them at the back of my mind, although I didn't know if they'd be available. I only had 3 days. But I think on this occasion, it worked well for us. If I'd had a couple of months, I'd have had people bouncing off me, people moving the goalposts, agents going, we've another club waiting. But this time, the players and their clubs had a quick decision to make. I had to make offers for them. But you'll need to make your mind up because you'll have to have a medical tomorrow. No one was taking a pay cut. We'd no one coming in from AC Milan. We were paying decent money for that level. Not 30 or 40,000 a week, but 12 or 15, something like that. Graham Kavanagh and Dave Connolly were at Wigan and that helped. We weren't dealing with 6 different clubs for 6 players. We had the 2 lads from Wigan. Ross Wallace and Stan Varga were at Celtic. And Liam Miller was being released by Manchester United. It was a great lift. You go out training with one group of players, and the next day 5 or 6 international players come out with you. It was Niall who made the calls and did the deals. He rang Celtic's chief executive, and he'd have rung the agent to see if, say, Ross Wallace fancied the move. I have a reputation for being a loner, but I got on well with all these lads. I'd roomed with Graham Kavanagh when we were with Ireland. I was staying in a cottage at the back of the hotel, so I had a bit of room and privacy. Ross and Stan came with their agent. He represented both of them. I'd played with them a few months earlier at Celtic, so the conversation was easy. Do you fancy it, lads? It was very straightforward. We're pretty average, but if you come on board, and I'm trying to get another couple of lads in, we'd be all right. They went, yeah. And I went, brilliant. I put the kettle on. It was as simple as that. I almost wish I'd kept that approach more. To be myself. I had to pull a few teeth to get Dave Connolly. Michael Kennedy represented Dave, and I knew he'd play hardball. There was no problem there. Even though Michael had represented me, he'd negotiated my contract with Sunderland. But Michael was representing his client here, not me or Sunderland. I knew the business. I needed a striker, and Michael would get the best deal for his client. Dave was going, oh, I don't want to leave Wigan. And I went, listen, Dave, compare Wigan to Sunderland. I brought in good players and good characters. They made my job easier. Somebody asked Capello years ago how come he was such a good manager. He said, I've been very fortunate. I've always worked with good players. Never forget that. Never give managers too much credit. But don't knock them too much when things are going bad. I think it was Jock Steen who said, "Football is about the fans and the players. Never get too carried away about the